Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. You can find Inforum online at www.commonwealthclub.org/inforum, and I'm Orly Cotel of the Sierra Club. Tonight we have a special guest, an Australian mountain climber who likes to say that on May 25th, 2006, he died on Mount Everest. Please welcome Lincoln Hall.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Lincoln, your story really baffles the imagination here. What does it mean when you say that you died on Mount Everest?
I guess ultimately it means that death, as far as the way I see it, isn't as black and white as I used to think. So that's sort of why I put it like that. It's also a bit of an attention grabber, I suppose, and because people don't like to. I guess death's one of those things that we don't have much to do with. And even as a mountaineer with a dozen friends dead over, you know, the 30 odd years I've been climbing, I thought I had a fairly realistic understanding and impression of death and what it was about, and I discovered that it's actually quite different. So I guess I open up a discussion by making that statement.
Well, let's start by talking a little bit about the events that happened on that day and that evening for our audience members who might not be familiar with the story that's in your new book. You summited that day to the top of Mount Everest. It was a lifelong dream of yours. And then what happened afterwards that caused you to be pronounced dead?
Well, actually, just it wasn't a lifelong dream. It's just that we could get the sponsorship money more easily. and you might think I'm joking, but that was a real factor. I started rock climbing when I was 15, and one thing led to another, and and I ended up working as a trekking guide and doing a lot of climbing in the Himalaya, and next mountain on the list was Everest. I mean, there were other things perhaps we found. We expected to be more interesting as a climb, but we felt that the first Australian expedition would be a great thing to do because we'd have no trouble getting funding, which, of course, wasn't true. It's always hard to get funding. But, so that doesn't answer your question, does it? Which was...
Well, let's talk about what you describe in your book, that day.
Oh, when the 25th.
You reached the top of Everest. I think for most people, they consider that to be the height of difficulty. And I don't think a lot of people are aware of how challenging it is to also get down from the summit of a mountain.
Yeah. Well, I guess one of the things about the north side of Everest, and I guess the south side as well, is that definitely on the north side, it's easy to get to dangerously high heights. In a technical sense, the climbing up to the North Col is pretty straightforward, and some seasons it's a bit more difficult than others, but with small steep sections. It was actually very easy in 2006. And then from the North Col, you have a climb from 23,000 up to 25,000 that's just a big, long, boring snow plod. And then from there, it gets more interesting as climbing. And then on the final session, well, the final segment to the summit from the camp three, our top camp at 27,000 feet, the climbing actually gets quite interesting. I mean, there's some easy sections, but there's definitely some more technical sections, which also require more effort coming down, which is the big thing about it. You have a very long summit day there. But everything went very well for me. I was on the mountain to be a high-altitude cameraman, but my two people that I was filming had health issues and had to give up, so there I was. I could go to the summit, which is what I did, and it went very, very well. I was really pleased to get to the summit at 9 a.m. in the morning, the whole day ahead of me, and perfect weather, and it seemed like nothing could go wrong, which, of course, you should never think that. Mm.
And so what did go wrong on the way down for you?
What happened about 100 feet or so below the summit, I was feeling weary. Well, that's not surprising, because the reality of the heights of Mount Everest, the extreme heights, is that to get to that top camp, you haven't really got much sleep since you left the North Col. You haven't eaten much. You haven't had enough to drink. Your metabolism it's not just the shortage of oxygen. Your metabolism sort of does all sorts of things, like make you feel nauseous. And so you really are pretty drained by the time you get to that top camp, and then you start climbing at midnight. And it's cold enough up there without doing it in the dark. So it's a pretty intense climb to the summit, and by the time you get there, hopefully the sun's up so you can get some nice photos. But what you don't see in the photos is the fact that even when you're breathing oxygen, meaning when you've got supplementary oxygen equipment, you've still only got 50% of the oxygen you might have at sea level. Because sometimes also your oxygen mask the little valve gets frozen up, so you get even less oxygen. So with the hypoxia, what that means is, the hypoxia meaning the shortage of oxygen, with the hypoxia, you become lightheaded. It's harder to make decisions. Back in 1984, when I first attempted Everest, it was a small Australian team, and we climbed without oxygen totally. It was a new route without oxygen. I turned back 1,000 feet or so below the summit because I calculated we would get to the top at dark, and I decided that was just too dangerous for me. And sure enough, that's what happened. And two of the guys reached the summit. One had frostbite his fingers are half the length of mine, and mine not exactly long. And so I know what it's like without oxygen. And you really need to, when I did the very simple math, when I thought, okay, I'm at this height, it's this time, it's going to take this long to get to the summit. And I did that sum three times, and I got it right. Very simple arithmetic. But it was like doing, the hardest calculus. It's a very marginal place to be, and you don't get that impression from a lot of stories. I think a lot of mountaineers who write climbing stories, that's just part of their life, that hypoxia. They don't make anything of it, but that's a very big thing on about climbing Everest. And so even though I felt in very good shape, it's still a very tenuous situation. And I was tired. We'd only stopped three times in that 9 hours. And even the first time, I didn't even want to sit down just because it was cold. Anyway, so 100 feet below the summit, I was feeling really tired, and that didn't surprise me. But then I became so tired that I felt like I was covered in, like I was made of lead and sinking into the snow. I just felt incredibly heavy. And then I sort of don't remember what happened after that. But I do know what happened, because the three Sherpas who were with me told me afterwards. And basically, I was stricken with cerebral edema. Cerebral edema is when what happens? Cerebral edema you can get in various different ways, but at high altitude, it's fluid retention within your skull. It's caused by your metabolism going haywire due to the shortage of oxygen. And I actually had some Diamox, which is a diuretic, which is an effective medicine for edema at altitude. But I didn't have the classical symptoms, which is a strong headache across here and double vision. But I have rescued someone with cerebral edema, and what the situation there is, you've got someone who's aggressively uncooperative. They just want to sit in the snow muttering nonsense. What happened was I was actually did a lot worse than that. I wanted to go back up the mountain. Apparently there were three black women up there I wanted to meet. and the Sherpas. Yes, perhaps. Yes. Yeah, one more time. Yes, I wasn't looking for women the first time. Anyway, we won't go there. So I wasn't only just going up the mountain looking for black women. I was also trying to jump off the mountain. I was pulling the oxygen mask off my face. I mean, I was totally delirious. And while I'd collapsed, feeling incredibly exhausted, now that I was had this really serious case of cerebral edema, I was just had more. I had energy to burn, and I burned it. And I burnt the Sherpas' energy as well, because they were trying to. They actually put a rope on me and had to drag me down the slope. And we got to the second step, and the second step is I guess it's the hard part. It's the equivalent of the Hillary step on the south side. It's a real bottleneck. It's where people turn back, and or where they get into trouble. And so the second step's a 100-foot high cliff, and on the way down, it was funny with the cerebral edema, because I sort of drifted in and out of it, and that isn't really typical. Usually you just get it and you go downhill and you die. And with the person that I'd rescued with cerebral edema, sure, we got him down about 2,500 feet, and he was perfectly fine the next morning, apart from some frostbite. But whereas for me, I just sort of drifted in and out. Whenever there was a technical section that I had to cope with, some steeper rock and that kind of thing, I was able to sort of come more back into the realistic, into the real world. And
so once you were being uncooperative and it was very clear that you were not going to come down the mountain easily,
mm-hmm.
the Sherpas had to make a decision at some point whether to stay with you and risk their own lives or to go back. What happened at that point?
What happened at that point what happened at that point was coming down the second step was quite an episode. And we might touch on that again when we talk about death. But it got to a point where I was so exhausted that I couldn't even move. Pemba was injured because I'd actually swung into him and slapped his leg with my crampon, you know, the spiky things you put on your boots. So I didn't realise that till afterwards, actually. But so Pemba was in a bad way. Four Sherpas then, actually, were exhausted. Pemba said to me, "Lincoln, you're going to have to spend the night here." And it was just on this tiny little space, smaller than this actually, and with a 8,000-foot drop over that side and a bit less on this one. And I wanted to say, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to spend the night. I'll have a rest and I'll go down. And because that's what I've done on every other mountain where it's suddenly, you know, where things have gone wrong, we've been caught in a storm or there's been some other drama and we're just really pushing it just to get down alive. And sometimes you get so exhausted you just have to have a rest and then find the little bit of energy that gets you that bit further down. And the lower down you get, the bit more oxygen and it gets easier. So that's what I was going to do. But unfortunately, I couldn't say that to Pemba because I couldn't even speak. I had the words formed in my head, but my mouth wasn't obeying my brain. Well, that part of my brain was turned off. So, and then basically everything went quiet, and I enjoyed the sunset. Yeah.
And they left you there on the mountain.
Well, yeah, it was 2 hours later after not being able to determine any signs of life from me, that the expedition leader Alex Abramov, who was down at the advanced base camp, ordered them to come down for their own to save their own lives.
Tell us about the night that you spent alone at the top of the world when you realized that nobody was coming back for you that evening.
Oh, well, I didn't realize that. I kept looking at my watch. I did have a watch, but I couldn't look at it because it was pitch black. And because I was dead, the Sherpas took my pack, which had useful things like fluid and some extra clothing and flashlights, you know, headlights, and you know. So it was, So I didn't, I couldn't look around for anyone because there was no point because it was totally pitch black. It had snowed, so I couldn't even see the stars. I was very lucid, incredibly cold. I could feel there was a big cold draft coming from somewhere, so I knew I was on the edge of something. And when I eventually got light, my right knee was about a foot away from the precipice. So that was interesting. But and in fact, I was left lying down. But when I came to, I was actually sitting cross-legged. So which is actually quite a sensible position to sit in to conserve warmth. Then I realised that this was the end because I knew where I was, and I knew that my fingers were frozen already because I could tell the wooden feeling of frostbite, and I just thought, well, I'm just going to freeze up here and that'll be the end of it. It's so easy to die there because of the hypoxia, because of the hypothermia, because of the dehydration, because of exhaustion, and of course because of the cerebral edema, which is almost a guaranteed killer on its own. So
nobody had ever survived at such heights overnight before without supplies, right?
Well, no, people have survived at that height, but they've always either been with someone else, and or they haven't been dead to start with, which was my situation. And and there's probably only half a dozen people who fit into that category of who have spent nights above that 28,000 feet out in the open.
So what did you do to survive that evening?
Well, I... evening makes it sound like, you know, well, what...
that cold,
about like
freezing
a boring
night
evening. How am I going to get through this evening without any interesting conversation? No, it wasn't like that at all. But, what I did was I had nothing. I had my brain and my body, neither of which were in good shape. But I used my body as a tool. I mean, people sometimes say I'm a tool, so... all I could do was get through. I just had to get through the night, and then I would see where I was, and then I would be able to make some sort of assessment of what I would try to do next. But the first thing was to get through the night. I mean, I faced an impossible situation, but I learned many years ago. In my early seasons climbing in New Zealand, when I gave up, in fact there proved to be no reason to give up, and I thought, well, that was close, and I've never given up since. So I wasn't going to give up now. So I just had to get through the night, and what I did was, I guess I used the focus that has developed through decades of climbing. When you're on a big climb that's continually technically demanding, that requires a huge amount of focus because you've got to be very careful about your climbing. You've got to be aware of the weather. You've got to be aware of avalanche dangers. You've got to be aware of what your climbing companions are up to. There's so much you have to bear in mind, and keep an eye on a clock as well. And so you develop this sort of a focus that really intensifies your senses, and that is actually... That's actually one of the really addictive things about mountaineering, is the intensity of the experience. I mean, you just feel like 200% alive rather than just 100. So it's that's the addictive part of it. So that focus that I'd learnt, I applied that night, and also used the focus that I'd learnt through meditation over 20-odd years. And I didn't want to meditate because that could take me into some other state from which I would not return. So I just used that focus on my physical body, being aware of my body. And I tried doing that, and then I started to drift off, and I thought, well, I've got to be a bit more coarse about this, a bit more gross, meaning I couldn't just think about, feel my body, because I couldn't feel it really. I had to be... I was put my arms under my... my hands in my armpits, which helped keep the fingers warm. Not that that was... Well, they were frozen, so I guess they weren't warm, but just cooled my armpits. But so I tried rocking backwards and forwards, and that was sort of almost a reassuring movement. But then I found that it was getting a bit hypnotic, so then I had to sort of rock forwards and backwards, and then I found what was really working. What I found was really working was to was to rotate this way a few times and then change and go the other way, because that was a slightly more complex movement. I mean, it doesn't seem complex at all, but when your brain's hardly working, it was enough to keep me awake through the night. So, and time just seemed to vanish. I've got no idea what time it was when I realised, when I suddenly came to. Time just didn't become an issue.
Now, the next morning, you were found by Dan, is his name pronounced Mazur, Mazur?
Mazur, Dan Mazur, yeah.
So what's your relationship like today with Dan Mazur, the climber who found you and rescued you the morning after you died and came back to life?
Well, good, actually. There were four climbers, actually, and they all leapt into action.
They just saw you sitting there as they came up the mountain?
Yes. Well, they. It was quite an interesting little exchange, because I said to them, the first thing I said to them was, I started a bit, and then I said, I imagine you're surprised to see me here. And they were. They'd been told that I'd been dead. I'd been left for dead the previous night. How could I possibly be eloquent enough to say that? And but the reason is, the way I see it, is that during that night of just managing to hang in to where I was, hang on to my physical reality, hanging on to my physical reality involved me forgetting about what had gone there, what had put me there. And I wasn't really concerned about what I was going to do next. All I knew was I had to keep a grip on my physical body. And that's what happened, and that's why time sort of vanished, because I was right in that present moment. And so when those four guys arrived, I was still in that present moment. And so I wasn't thinking, oh, thank God I'm got, you know that's over, I'm no longer there, having suffered all that stuff. And I wasn't thinking, oh, now here's the chance to go down. I wasn't thinking past, present. I wasn't thinking past and future. I was thinking, oh, people, hello. And so Dan quickly established that I wasn't as compos mentis as it appeared. There's a fixed rope that goes all the way from the base of Everest up to the summit that the commercial expeditions put up cooperatively. And so that rope was right there, but because I was dead, I wasn't clipped onto it. So Jangbu clipped onto it. And Miles Osborne, when he heard me say those words, he thought, I must be hallucinating. That man possibly could not possibly be saying that, because he looks like he's about to die. And Andrew Brash was in tears for the same reason. He thought I was going to die. And anyway, Miles gave me something to drink. And then my book is called Dead Lucky. And the reason for that, well, is there's so much luck involved in this. For instance, Dan was testing a miniature version of a new kind of oxygen system. So he had the regular system and he had this miniature version of a new kind. So how lucky is it you're going to come across a guy who's got a spare oxygen set at 28,000 feet? So then we were all able to partake of oxygen. So, and they didn't, I mean, we talked, you know, there was a big debate about ethics after the 2006 Everest season because of various other things that happened. But in terms of Dan and his team, there was no discussion about whether they should help me. It was just what they were going to do. They were pretty angry about it, thinking, well, who's left this guy here? And Miles thought at first that I might have been some sort of super climber who's just having a bit of a rest, but he quickly realised that wasn't the case. So, yeah.
But there have been other cases, many cases in Everest history, of people walking by someone who's dying in their own quest to reach the summit.
I don't really know about that. I mean, it's not something that's featured in the stuff that I've read or the people I've talked to. Certainly in 2006, that was blown up out of all proportion because of the issue of David Sharp, who was a British climber who chose to climb the mountain pretty well in the same style that we attempted in 1984. He was climbing by himself, but there were hundreds of people on the mountain. There was that fixed rope going all the way to the top. He did have two oxygen cylinders. I think he ultimately only took one with him. And there were quite a few other climbers who travelled like that, just had one oxygen cylinder for the final push to the summit. So, I mean, but anyway, he got near the summit, we think, and got back down to around 26,000 feet or a bit higher than that. And in fact, you know, it would have been more like 27,000 feet. And he sort of sheltered in a cave, and it appeared that he had died. And 40 climbers went past him in that cave. There was another body who was there, or which was there. I think you'd probably say which one. The body's been there for many years, which it had been. And so the climbers went up to the summit, and it was the 14th of May. It was the coldest night of the season. Everybody... there were more cases of frostbite that night than the rest of the season put together. I mean, it was a really cold season, very clear skies mostly. But so when people came down, that's when people realised David Sharp was alive. As I was saying earlier about the hypoxia and how you're just hanging in there, a very tenuous grasp of reality, well, that was on the way up when we were going up the mountain. You've got a headlamp on, so you can see this sort of area about 2 feet wide directly in front of you, and that's what you're watching, because you don't want to put. You've got to watch where you put your feet, because you don't want to go off the edge, all that effort, and you fall off the top. I mean, so you know, it's not like, and people, when you know there are dead bodies up there, you don't go looking for them and, you know, sort of, you know, doing a sort of skater dude's tag on them or anything like that. I mean, you just don't want to know about it, really. And so it's very easy to walk past someone who's dead, and it's very easy to walk through past someone who you think is dead and who's just having a rest, because they're not going to take their oxygen mask off and say hello. They're just going to rest, because it's quite fiddly getting your mask back on and with your goggles and all that sort of stuff. So, the message came through, and this is part of one of the curses of modern communications, is the word got down to base camp that David Sharp, or this person, they didn't know who he was at that point, was alive. And then it was immediately thought that everyone had known that he was alive and just sort of pushed him out of the way, and that wasn't what happened at all. And it was only on the way down that some people realised he was alive. And there was a Turkish expedition, the leader of that, and another Turkish climber spent a couple of hours trying to stand him up, and his legs were frozen solid. They didn't bend. I mean, it was amazing that he was alive with frozen legs. So, yeah.
What is your view on the climber's code of ethics, as it were? At what point should someone risk their own life for another climber, and at what point do you need to leave them to die?
Well, I guess whenever I've faced someone who's in trouble, I've always been there, and I think that's the predominant response. I think it's a similar sort of ethics that we have in normal life, except I think it's actually probably stronger, because you know, as a mountaineer, you are very aware of how dangerous it is, and very likely you've had friends who have died, and or you know of people who have died, famous mountaineers, and so it's. And you also, if you've climbed a lot of mountains, you know it's just another mountain, and you can always go back. And in fact, I have a friend who climbed Everest on his fifth attempt, and so, you know, the mountains will always be there. So, and human life won't. If it's gone, it's gone. And I think that a lot of mountaineers are aware of that, and so that the ethical sense of helping, really, what people usually do is they manage to assess the situation before it's impossible to pull out. But sometimes something like the cerebral edema that I had can kick in too quickly, that there's no chance to actually get them down. So I think there's actually a very strong ethical practice amongst climbers. And I think, you know, you get more people walking past homeless people who may or may not be dead on the street, you know. No one wants to get involved with that scene.
What do you think you would have done if you had been one of the Sherpas who left you on the mountain? Do you blame them? Do you harbor resentment for what they did?
Not at all. No, not at all. I mean, the worst possible thing for me would have been if I had survived as I did, and they didn't. I mean, they had less. They would have been. They left, used less oxygen than I did. I mean, admittedly, they're much more naturally acclimatized, but yeah, they were still totally beat. You know, from we had a 19-hour day coming down, and it wasn't just an average 19-hour day. It was when I was trying to jump, go up the mountain, and jump off, and all that kind of thing. And yeah, so. So I would, you know, when I got down, Pemba, one of the Sherpas, when I finally got back to base camp, he was there, and he and the others were, I don't know where they were, I think they were packing up somewhere. And, you know, I just gave him this big hug and just sort of was, I was apologising for putting him through what I'd put them through. And he was just saying, it's fine, it's okay, don't worry, you're alive, that's all. And that's, you know, that was how what they, that was what they were going to do. They were going to do what they could for me. And the fact that they left me at that point at 28,000 feet, had they left me where things went wrong for me, by the time Dan Mazur and his team got up there, they probably wouldn't have been in any condition. They wouldn't have been strong enough to help me. And and the chances are that much higher up that I would have... that. Closeness to death would have been eliminated, and I'd just be dead. So that was the first phase of the rescue, and then Dan and his team radioed for some other Sherpas from our team to come up with oxygen, and that allowed me to get down under my own steam. And that's really the big difference between me and David Sharp, was that, well, partly I guess I was more mentally active, but also I could walk off the mountain and he couldn't. And the other thing about the fact that there's a third of the oxygen in the air at that extreme height is that when you've got a big... David Sharp was a big guy as well. If you've got a body that weight, it's almost three times as... It feels three times as heavy because of the lack of oxygen. You don't have the energy. So it's, you know, it's very, very difficult to bring people down from that height, and that's why it's called the Death Zone.
In 2006, which is the year that you died on Everest, 11 other climbers lost their lives to that mountain that year. Is death an accepted or... even an expected part of the sport now?
Well, if it's not, you're not being realistic. I mean, as a mountaineer, it sounds crazy to think, oh, yeah, well, I might die this time. But, I mean, a good friend of mine, he was the first Australian to climb the six highest mountains without oxygen, told me, hasn't told his wife this, but that every time he goes out, oh, he's given up now. I mean, he's done his achieved his goal. He never knows when he goes out the door to the airport whether he'll come back. And he was on the mountain during the Into Thin Air disaster as a guide. So and he did come back. But yeah, so it's a very marginal thing. But it's a matter of being aware of those dangers. And I don't think that death. I mean, it was a particularly bad season. I mean, there were nine Sherpas were killed back in 1922, I think, in an avalanche. And then the next worst season was 1996 with the Into Thin. I mean, there were the 12 deaths there, not all of them from the storm. And then there were 11. Well, there were 12 deaths in 1996 there were 12 deaths, and then 2006 there were 12 deaths, and then I sat up, which brought it back to 11. But... I guess so. Death. It's, you know, that season. It was almost like a trap, because the skies were so clear. There was very little in the way of clouds. I mean, there was the odd sort of cloud blowing through, but and because there were no clouds, it was so much colder. And people who perhaps might have been people who hadn't done much climbing, who may have been dispirited by encountering a storm, weren't turning back because it was just beautiful conditions. And so, and then up at those impossible heights, when things went wrong, they tended to go very wrong.
So even with all the dangers, what makes you do it? Why do you climb?
Well, there's a huge potential for making really bad jokes. A sense of humour is a very constructive thing. It somehow is some kind of optimism there. In fact, laughter evolved as a response to danger. So, took to climbing when I was 15, and it was the intensity of that, the engagement with the physical world, the combination of mind and body and spirit, really, that I found addictive. And I guess it becomes even more intense on big mountains, because then there's all those other dangers thrown in. And also, I guess, in our modern lives, we have... I'm sure you here all got things to do when you go back home, and you've got to worry about work, or if you're unemployed, you've got to think about work, or you've got relationship issues, or whatever it is. Whereas when you're on a mountain, you've got you've got a goal, you've got a specific goal, and you either get up there or you don't, and you either come back alive or you don't. So there's a resolution. Whereas I think so often in life, there might be closure of one thing, but the opening of the next. And then life is very complicated, and your mind gets full of all this stuff. Whereas on a big mountain, that becomes your reality, and it becomes your total existence, really. Your whole focus is on that.
So how do you prepare yourself for the mental and the spiritual aspect of climbing?
Well, the spiritual, I mean, both those things are almost automatic, actually. The physical one requires a little bit more work. Whenever I go on an expedition, as soon as I make the decision to go, there's a sort of a switch in my mind that puts everything else as a second priority, because you've got to start planning. You've got to start planning and preparing. I mean, I guess it is a big psychological step, and so you've got to sort of harden your mind. Not harden it, but just harden it in the way that it becomes something which allows you to push through whatever you're going to face. So there's a real sort of steely-eyed approach to things. And and it's also, I think I write about it in the book, where I actually got to base camp and started to feel the transformation of leaving everything else behind and just becoming not quite one with the mountain, but one with the process of climbing the mountain. And that's an extraordinarily, I really welcome that feeling. Mm. Yeah.
Your wife and your two sons went through the unimaginable experience of learning of your death, and then, of course, later learning of what some call your resurrection. What was the reunion with your family like, and how has it affected your relationships with them?
The reunion was actually not sort of disappointing in a way, because my wife had changed the locks. No, that's not true. It was disappointing because, not disappointing is not quite the right word. My wife flew to Kathmandu to meet me, and I had to stay there for a few days because they didn't know whether I was going to survive. I mean, I knew I was going to survive, God, after what I'd gone through. But so I was there for a week, and another friend had come with Barbara, and so I was sort of debriefing with them, and I wasn't really talking to my sons or our dogs. And when we got back to when we came back to Australia, we arrived late one night, and the next morning was the memorial service for a very good friend of mine, Sophia, who died 3 days after I did on Manaslu. There was a big, they were in a snow bowl, and the bottom fell out of it, a huge crevasse, and she just disappeared, and there was no word from her, and the person she was climbing with was lucky to escape with his life. So, I mean, she died. And so that morning we had attended her memorial service, and I was just a mental and emotional wreck, really, and physical too. And so we went to that very sad event, and then we drove 2 hours up to our home and where our sons were, and that was great. But certainly, I guess the joy of the reunion was tainted by what had happened to Sue. But in terms of our relationship, I mean, there was never any resentment. It was just the way forward, and it's made us much closer, and certainly both my sons, I mean, I wouldn't wish it on them, I wouldn't wish it on anyone, but certainly that was an extraordinary experience that they went through when they thought I had died. And I think that's the worst part of all this, is what my family went through.
How has the experience changed you?
The recovery was just a huge thing. Not that I noticed, I just noticed I was getting better, but there just seemed to be just more better and better to get. It's still sort of going on almost. But I suppose in a spiritual way, it's been amazing, and psychological too, because there were experiences that I had with that experience with death, of being so close to death, but still being able to sidestep it. I mean, that was an extraordinary experience. I mean, death was there, it was welcoming, it was nothing to be afraid of, but I decided not to take the invitation. And and I'm not afraid of death. And I thought, as a mountaineer with friends who've died and facing dangerous situations, I thought I had death as understood death, but really now I'm not afraid of it. And that's an amazing sort of philosophical leap for me. It was actually, yeah, philosophical, metaphysical, and spiritual, I suppose.
We're going to be taking questions from the audience soon, so please start lining up at the mic now if you'd like to ask a question. I'm curious, you lost 8 tips of your fingers.
Yep.
Because of that day on the mountain, the whole experience on the mountain. What is that like for you now, every day, going through your life with this sign, this visible symbol of what you've gone through?
Well, one of my friends, before I'd had my operation, said, look, because despite the fact that I'm traveling the States telling my story, I'm actually quite modest about what I've done. And my friend said, well, now you're not going to be able to escape it, because that's going to be with you for the rest of your life. And I thought, oh, yeah, great. But look, it's better than being dead. There's no doubt about that. And I'm not going to get gunk under my fingernails, because I haven't got any. But I would say that reaching the summit wasn't worth losing my fingertips over, but the insights and the understandings that I gained through that experience were worth this, yeah. And I can do pretty well. I can do most things, and it's when it's my turn to buy the drinks. Well, my hands just aren't long enough. Fingers aren't long enough to get the change.
When people ask you how you lost those fingers, do you tell them the whole story? Do they believe you if you do tell them the story?
Well, people are polite enough not to ask, really. Yeah, generally. So, I tell them if they ask. Yeah, but It doesn't happen very often. And often, actually, you don't really notice when I'm just walking along. People are looking in the shop windows to seeing if their hair is in place, rather than looking at my hands.
That's true. Yeah. I guess before we go to the audience questions, I think a question that must be on everyone's mind when they get an opportunity to talk with you about this is, before all these disastrous events happened, when you were at the top of Mount Everest, what was going through your mind when you're on top of the world at the summit?
Well, certainly there's a sort of feeling that there was not a huge elation, because that can be a mesmerizing effect, and people, you know, I just knew that I had to focus on doing what I needed to do, which was taking the view, which I certainly did. There was no way I was going to forget that. But I knew that the descent is the hard part. But it was extraordinary. I mean, we were looking down. There was a sea of clouds 5,000 or 6,000 feet below, which made it just feel even higher. And the actual summit, when you come from the northern side, you step about a foot or so up onto the crest to the very highest point. And it's quite narrow. It's about half the width of the stage here, and so there's not much room at all on the highest point, and so you're just right there, and there's these giant mountains all around, they look small, and everything else looks insignificant. And you think, you know, it looks like you can see the curvature of the Earth, but you can't, of course. It just looks that way. I mean, it really, and you look up and it looks dark. I mean, you just feel that if you stepped off, you'd float up. Well, of course you don't, and I didn't try. But you just feel that you're right on the edge of things and you could just go away. You know, it's extraordinary.
Do you have plans to try and climb again?
Well, I'm rock climbing already, but I don't know really. And maybe not. We'll just see what happens. But certainly I don't want to go to those extreme altitudes because that cerebral edema hit me and I don't know why and I don't want to risk that again.
Well, we're going to take questions from the audience now, if you'd like to step forward and ask your question.
Thank you. Very interesting. Thank you. Very interesting.
Can you tell me, do you think the use of commercial guides and the taking people to the summit, attempting to take people to the summit of Mount Everest, do you feel that has trivialized the experience or the event? Do you think that somehow it's impacted mountaineering in ways that are different today than mountaineering was 20 years ago?
Well, I have to say yes to all that, all those points. But at the same time, you know, I've been lucky enough to achieve all sorts of mountaineering goals, as I've said. And who am I to deny the dreams of others? And post 96, I think there was a huge rationalization in how climbing was guided climbing was being done. I think that it's just the way it is. The world's getting more crowded, and there's so much. It's much better understanding of high altitude physiology. The gear's better. The communications are better. The weather forecasts are better. So it is really safer than it was. But having said that, it doesn't need much of a change in environmental conditions to create a death trap, and that's always going to be there. And I think the big thing about guided people who are guided is. Mostly people who are guided up Everest are people who have done all of their climbs as clients. And so they have never had to dig deep into themselves in survival situations because the guide's job is to pull them out of that situation before they get trapped in it. So when high on Everest, where things go wrong, they haven't got that never give up attitude built into their psyche. And so they die needlessly, perhaps. I think it's actually much more dangerous for those people. I mean, it's unfortunate that it is a magnificent place, but on the other hand, it is very crowded. But on the other hand, you know, there's the route that I climbed in 2006. There's the original route in from 1953. The rest of the mountain is empty. 99% of the people are on those two routes. If you want to climb Everest and have an experience with no one around, the mountain's there. You'll just might meet some crowds on the top. So it's the Everest experience in its pure form is available if you want it.
As a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're talking with Lincoln Hall. I'm Orly Cotell of the Sierra Club. We'll take another question from the audience now.
Loss of oxygen produces dead brain cells, and thus my question is, have you noticed a diminution in the alacrity or clarity of your thought either immediately after the accident or continuing today?
Well, actually, regarding the acuity of my brain operations, they've been out of kilter for quite a long time, what does happen, and I know this from my friends who have done a lot of climbing without oxygen, that there's definite short-term memory loss, and that can be lasting for those people who've spent a lot of time above 8,000 metres, above 26,000 feet without oxygen. But in my own case, in 2006, I had this peculiar situation of I was started to write my book, and I found that even though I couldn't write because I had frostbite, I could sort of write, but I was trying to dictate. But I could think of everything I wanted to say when I was writing. But when I tried to speak it, I couldn't find even the simplest words, you know, like outdoors or something like that. It just wouldn't come. And I have a friend who's a psychiatrist, and he said, well, that's not unusual because speech is another level of complexity in the neurological, I guess, hierarchy. And whereas thought, which is basically writing, is classified as thought, is a lesser level of complexity. And that's why I was able to think of these complex words, but I couldn't speak them. It was a very strange feeling. So it definitely does interfere with your mind, but I think that in terms of intelligence and problem solving, I have no greater difficulties than I used to have.
Remarkable story. What do you think of this ascent, I think it was last year, of the team that replicated George Mallory's 1924 ascent using the gear of that era and the clothing of that era, and I think, and following the same north side route, I believe, that you went up?
I mean, for those of you who don't know the Mallory story, Mallory and Irvine were two British climbers who disappeared in 1924, very high on the mountain, and there's been a constant sort of interest in whether they reached the summit or not, and a constant debate, and there's been expeditions and books and films, and so I'm not quite sure why, but there's this huge interest in it. I guess sometimes dead people, you know, there's a mystique there. So I think that, I mean, I know that what happened in that reenactment was two of the world's best climbers managed to climb the infamous second step without using the ladder that the Chinese had put there, and it had been climbed once by the Chinese in 1960, but the guy who did that took his boots off and was stood on someone's shoulders and got quite very bad frostbite, and he was actually the liaison officer on our 1984 expedition. So, my feeling is that they would not have been able to climb it. I don't believe that they could have reached the summit. Yeah.
Could you talk briefly about your nutrition, especially when you were working at the higher altitude and dealing with some of the effects of high altitude?
Yeah, well, I'm a vegetarian and have been since 1981 in October when I ate too many of Mr. Rand's goat momos. But I only ate them out of politeness anyway. But so vegetarian diets are very good for high altitude, I mean, because meat takes a lot longer to digest, though that's not the reason I don't eat meat. But I had short notice to go on this expedition, and I didn't know what the catering would be like. So I took a whole lot of fruit that we actually dried in our desiccator, and I took that across. And when I say we, my wife and I. but I also take nutritional supplements, and I'm convinced that they're a vital part of. I think they played a role in my survival because 2 months at that altitude at those extreme, you know, above, you know, 17,000 feet, even though there's lots of food on there, there's not much fresh food. And the fresh food that's there has been frozen because it's so cold, and it's old, and then the sun comes out and it gets hot and moldy, and so it's not good quality food. And so I think a lot of the vital functions in neurologically and in other I guess chemical reactions within your body, you really need these micronutrients, and you can get them through supplements. Normally you can get them through fresh food, but you can't in an expedition context, you don't have it there. So I was taking a multivitamin, a very comprehensive multivitamin phytonutrient antioxidant formula. I was taking bioginkgo. I was taking cordyceps, which is a Chinese, Tibetan fungus, which has been shown to increase lung function in elderly people by an improvement of 10%, which is pretty extraordinary. And what else was I taking? I said ginkgo, didn't I think? Yeah. So, I mean, those things. And what else? Oh, yes, and I was taking... I had flaxseed oil that I was taking as well. And the products I was using were all of the Pharmanex brand, which were very high quality. Yeah, but it's a very good question, and more people need to pay attention to that, I think. Yeah.
So kind of building on the guided question of Everest, back in like the 20s and up to the 50s, I think Everest was sort of the pinnacle of exploration, of certainly mountaineering. It was the final frontier, and this year we've seen the Olympic torch relayed to the summit. Do you think, two questions, do you think that was still in the tradition of the noble exploration of the mountain and the final frontier, or do you think that was a media stunt? And further, what do you think that is going to, how will that impact that sort of activity? Will that continue in the future? Will Everest continue to be sort of a place to demonstrate things like that, or?
Well, let's hope not. I think that the, good question, I think the torch thing was just a, I think it was a subjugation of, it was China putting its blood-stained thumb on the Nepalese government and forcing them to close down the mountain for 10 days, you know, so the Chinese could, I mean, my theory on it was the Chinese closed the mountain so that if they didn't get there, they could say they did. And the sort of ethics and soul, I think, was taken out of the Chinese government in the Cultural Revolution. So it's very, just very pragmatic. So I think it's very unfortunate that it's come to that. But the Chinese have demonstrated they can do this kind of thing, and maybe they'll make a habit of it. I know that there was a few years ago they were testing. There was a big Chinese company that was testing games that you could play on your mobile phones from the summit to the base camp. And that's fine. I mean, it's the ultimate sort of advertising. But I think when it comes to interfering with the livelihood of a very poor nation like Nepal, and also on the Tibetan side where it's closed for the whole season until 10th of May, I mean, that's a vital part of their livelihood, and it's just a bit of cultural imperialism. So,
what about some of the environmental effects of the larger numbers of people who are now using Everest as a playground to some extent? The people who are not necessarily experienced mountaineers but are coming on these adventure trips to go up there, discarding waste along the way?
Oh, well, look, the waste issue is... I think that there are... I mean, that is actually being looked after. On the Tibetan side, there are actually garbage trucks. And I don't know where they take the garbage, but they certainly take it away from base camp. And on the Nepalese side of the mountain, for many years now, there has been a $4,000 bond that you put in, and if you don't bring your rubbish out, you lose your bond. So, I mean, the unfortunate thing about that is on the Nepalese side of the mountain, you know, there's a bit of corruption going on, so you know you can get around that. But generally, it's the attitude is actually pretty good, and it's a lot worse in other parts of the world, actually. Yeah, it is a national park, and it's the shining light of Nepal as a country is the attraction of Mount Everest, and everyone's very proud of it, and they really do try to look after it. But some of the foreign groups, don't play the game. Well, they play the game because they can buy people off. But generally, that's a smaller part of it. Yeah.
What has surprised you the most about this entire experience?
Well, I guess my relationship with death. One thing I haven't mentioned was my first brush, I guess, with death on the climb was when I was coming down the second step, delirious, stopped for a little sleep for an hour. The Sherpas managed to rouse me, and I rappelled down far too quickly, gave myself a big fright, swung back across, and grabbed onto a rock and was thinking, oh, God, I'm just really frightened, and clinging onto this rock with a little big ledge for my feet, smaller hole for my hands. And then the next thing I know, I'm looking at my back, and I'm 30 feet up in space that way, and maybe 10 feet up, looking down on myself on the cliff. In fact, maybe more than 30 feet away. And I could see the other climbers, I could see the other Sherpas, and I was at that stage, I was so mentally incapacitated and emotionally incapacitated. I mean, I was scared, but I was basically observing what was happening. And the next thing I know, I'm back on the cliff. So that was an extraordinary thing. That's what they call a near-death experience. And that was just the beginning of a sequence of near-death experiences. The hallucinations I had the same, meaning, and there were different meanings there. And so that was a whole insight into how the mind works and how death is not as black and white, not as one step as we tend to think it is.
Mm. What do you think is next for you?
Whoa. Next for me? I don't know. Look, this is my eighth book. I've just written my ninth one, just finished it before I came across from Australia. But, I guess all sorts of opportunities have come my way through this, and that's not what I was looking for. But I've made great friends with people from that trip in 2006. The insights into all sorts of things, like when I was in the hyperbaric chamber 2 hours a day, 5 days a week for a month, I was sharing, I mean, what happens in there, you're breathing 2.4 atmospheres of pressure under 100% oxygen, and that allows a rapid healing to happen. And people I was with were cancer patients who had wounds that weren't going to heal in any other way, and if the wounds didn't heal there, that would be the end of their lives. So I was in there, and I was the lucky one. And just seeing the way the good heart and the commitment to taking whatever came their way, I mean, it was a very special thing. I mean, it wasn't directly to do with the mountain, but those kinds of interactions and realizations just opened up a whole new side of the world to me, I suppose. So I feel very lucky to have experienced those things.
What words of advice or inspiration would you have for backpackers, climbers, adventurers who are going out and trying to achieve goals that are difficult for them, challenging beyond their reach?
Well, I think you have to be realistic about what your capabilities are and also what you really want to do, what you really are prepared to risk. I think that there's an enormous benefit, particularly in these tough times, to be able to connect with nature and particularly to do that with other people, because it's a very wholesome and fulfilling part of life, I think. And so that would be my advice.
Anything else you'd like to add for our audience or our listeners?
Not that I can think of, really, but I guess I'm... I've been amazed by the inspiration that our story seems to have elicited amongst people. And, that wasn't just me managing to survive the night. It was the way people rallied around me when the chips were down. And when I came home, it was like attending my own funeral, you know, where everybody says nice things about you at your funeral, but you never hear them. Well, I got to hear them. So, I mean, it's really, I guess, given me a different view of myself and a more humble view. Mm.
Well, let's give a big hand to Lincoln Hall for sharing his thoughts.
Thank you.
And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.